Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki Balancing Form and Essence. I have with me today Justin Stein. For some of you who have been following the interviews for the past few years, you'll know that Justin has had two interviews. Mm-hmm. And now we're doing a third, mostly because I'm interested in his developing thoughts about Reiki and about this question that I've been putting to people. Is there a cosmology? Is there an understanding of the universe that comes through the practice of Reiki? And is it possible to articulate this? And this is what I'm interested in because I really feel that it might benefit Reiki students of all practices to have a feeling or an understanding about Reiki and what are the basic principles of Reiki, not the ones that we think about just for today, do not worry, but foundation blocks of the actual practice. So Justin, in your research, because I understand that you're doing research to note the changes that have happened through each time period, mm-hmm. As Reiki has developed from Mikao Usui. So I'm just wondering if there's a pattern that's emerging and if there is a cosmology that seems to hold the whole thing together.
That's a good question, Phyllis. Let me start by saying, you know, when we're looking to see, you know, the time of Dr. Usui, the materials we have are fairly limited and are still seems to be coming to light. There was a recent interview with Hiroshi Doi in Reiki News where he made reference to some handwritten notes by a student of Dr. Usui about Usui speaking that I had never heard of before. And I was a little surprised to hear about this material. But at the same time, the contents of that document seem to be fairly in line with the kind of cosmology that we received from your grandmother. Uh-huh. There was a lot of talk of the universe, mm-hmm. in Japanese, uchu. And there was something along the lines, I don't have it in front of me, but something along the lines of that I am in the universe and the universe is in me.
Mm.
And also the term komyo, for like the great light or enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And there's something similar, that I am in enlightenment and enlightenment is in me.
Uh-huh.
And so those sorts of ideas seem to be in line with kind of the Buddhist notion of original enlightenment, where all sentient beings have Buddha nature, and it's kind of our path, maybe, to uncover that original Buddha nature, as they call it.
I see.
And if you think about it, it's such a contrast from, I mean, Augustine's interpretation of the Christian theology of original sin is almost the opposite. Kind of, we originally are pure, and we originally are enlightened and one with the universe and other beings and something like that, which is a nice way to look at things. And it seems like you know, that was an element of Japanese religion that Usui was also kind of putting forth in his lectures, if these materials are authentic. I did some inquiry into these materials when I was in Japan this past year.
Uh-huh.
And from what I understand, Doi Sensei had met someone who held these materials and would not allow him to photocopy them or photograph them, but let him take notes of them, from them. So what he has is his notes from these notes. So at the same time, it's hard to verify this or that, but it seems to make sense in the other materials we have.
Uh-huh.
That, and when Sue asked if there's a pattern, I think there is this sense of, this expression of I am the universe and the universe is me is something actually that one of the women I spoke with in my research who studied with Takata in 1938 said she could, the thing is her memory isn't 100% at this point, so it's not clear if she heard this from Takata or if she heard this from her father, who also went back to Japan after the war and met with Chie Hayashi. But somewhere, either whether it's from Takata or from Chie Hayashi, a very, very similar phrase came to her through one of those channels.
Uh-huh.
And then my colleague at Waseda University, Hirano Naoko, she told me regarding that phrase that that was something that's very much in line with other spiritual therapies of the early 20th century from Japan. For example, there was a book that came out a couple of years ago called Usui's Teacher that was about Tanaka Morihei, who is the founder of a movement that was called Taireido, the way of the great day or spirit. And apparently his teachings were very close on this subject of... I'm not an expert in Taireido, but from what I heard from Hirano, the teachings of that movement, which were about a decade before Usui, were very close in that regard of kind of a macrocosm, microcosm, and that one achieving health and success in life had to do with aligning oneself to the macro.
Uh-huh. So don't you think that this is... kind of indigenous in the Japanese culture, because when I go back and read the tenets, mm-hmm. you know, the foundation principles of Shinto, it's very much the same. Everything is an expression of the divine, or everything is divine, and maybe not even an expression, and that... we would say now in the New Age culture, we are all one. Mm-hmm. But back there, then, they really celebrated the differences as well as the similarity of divinity.
Mm.
That's what I've gathered. And I think that that is, it fits better for me personally, because when I think about we are all one, it kind of creates a kind of mush vision in my head. But when I think about the Shinto concept that we are different and we are all divine, and that divinity, that spirit, allows us to be one,
mm-hmm.
then it creates this very distinct pattern of individualism within the whole.
Right.
And so is that kind of where...
There's a lot going on right there. I've got like so many. I almost like want to take some notes because there's like a bunch of things you made me think of. First of all, the idea, right, of kind of the loss of individuation and like
uh-huh.
the kind of mystic primal unity kind of thing that it seems like you're getting at. I mean, I've heard you talk about the absolute and the relative worlds.
Right.
And so on the absolute level, everything being part of the same... general mishmash, right? If you've ever seen I Heart Huckabees, you know, the blanket, I don't know, is the metaphor that like everything is part of the same wholeness. Is that something I associate with Shinto? It's something I associate more with esoteric Buddhism, with Kukai. And he taught a Kukai, if you don't know, is one of the huge figures in Japanese religion, both on kind of an esoteric practice level and also on an intellectual, especially certainly cosmological level. And he posited that the Buddha has three bodies. And this is something I think that existed before in mainland Asian Buddhist thought, but he really articulated in the Japanese setting, and that what he called the Dharmakaya, like the true body of the Buddha, is that everything is part of the Buddha, and that we are an expression of the Buddha and the Buddha's teaching.
Uh-huh.
All the sound in the universe is the Buddha teaching.
Uh-huh.
All the matter in the universe is the Buddha's body. And that is, in some sense, the realist level in Kukai's thought. And so When you say that, I think more of that, because when I think of Shinto, you know, certainly nature has deities and that they are to be worshipped. But at the same time, there is a real distinction. If you think about the gates,
right,
and then you go into the gate, and before you go into the gate, you have to purify.
Right.
And purification and pollution is like one of the prime kind of foundational concepts in Shinto. And so even, I mean, maybe, I'm not an expert on Shinto by any means, but you know, maybe on some level, everything has the potential for divinity, but some of it's polluted. It's, maybe because when you see a forest, a sacred forest in Shinto, there are particular trees that are set out from other ones. Mm-hmm. They put a rope around them saying, this tree is special. This one has... And maybe it's that it just has a more powerful kami in it, and that all the tree have kami, but that this one is more powerful because it's an older tree. It's a more special tree. That's something I would have to, you know, I'm not an expert, so I'm a little loath to go there. I know more about the Buddhist way of working. Uh-huh. So when you said that, the first thing I thought of really was esoteric Buddhism, which it seems there was some connection with
Hideki. Oh, definitely.
And so... And I mean, it says everything we have about Usui says that he had studied Buddhism. I would completely expect he knew the doctrine of original enlightenment, which is a particularly Japanese doctrine, and that's something I don't think you see in Chinese Buddhism, at least expressed in the same way. In Chan, they talk about the mirror that is, you know, in your heart or whatever, and that you need to clean the mirror, the dust that accumulates on it, and things like that. But it takes, I think, new prominence in the world of Japanese Buddhism, the doctrine of original enlightenment, and it becomes a really foundational thing. I think there's inklings of it in China, but it really becomes a major doctrine in Japan.
So tell me, maybe I've asked you this before. What does it mean in this doctrine, enlightenment?
It's a great question.
Well, like, how can you tell? Or, is it an experience? Is it an experience of someone? Is it an accumulation of a way of being? Like, I just
it's maybe easier to say what it's not. It's not.
Okay.
It's not a permanent state that all of a sudden you are enlightened and then the rest of your life you live as an enlightened being. At least for most of us, obviously there's the stories of the Buddhas and the who do achieve full awakening and live out their lives as awakened beings and then don't have any more rebirths, right? I mean, that's the big thing, is when you become a Buddha, you're not born again in this world, and you inhabit a Buddha world, which is kind of outside of our world in some ways. And so that's not what most people experience, I don't think. You know, when we talk, I mean, you might call someone, he's a real Buddha, but I don't think, anyway. So it's Satori, right? Satori, the... Satori, right? That's a sudden awakening experience where it seems one has a glimpse of the nature of things, but it seems like that it's a time slice, and that after Satori, or you may have many Satori experiences in one's life, but afterwards we come back to living in the world, and we try to bring some of that wisdom into the world.
So do you think that that's the experience of Mikao Usui?
Well, that's how it's described. And whether it's described in that way because his followers are understanding things from a Japanese religious standpoint or not, is debatable, but that's how it's described. And they talk about, in Buddhist terms, the komyo, that's a very Buddhist term for, the great light is seeing. It doesn't say that on the memorial stone. The memorial stone describes things, I think, in much more kind of Confucian terms, where it talks about he has this wisdom and this humaneness and this compassion, where he was this great man who made great learning, had this amazing experience, which the experience itself has Buddhist overtones because it's on Kodama, which is a mountain that was used in well, it's not just Buddhist, but like Shugen, the mountain asceticism. I mean, it's kind of, and he is definitely doing a sort of ascetic practice, 21 days of fasting and meditation. So that transcends just Buddhism. But yeah, certainly, you know, that school of Japanese mountain esoteric practice, which draws on elements of what we now call Shinto and Buddhism, whatever, but it was kind of its own thing in that time. But then in the, and again, you know, you every text, you know, kind of also betrays something about its author and not just its subject, but he really talks about how Usui's compassion, Usui's greatness was not that he had this experience, but that then he came down from the mountain and taught.
Yes.
And he brought it to the people, and he said, others need to learn how to do this.
Right.
That it's not enough that I have this power, but I need to learn how to give the power to others.
Right.
And that's really what the memorial stone calls his virtue. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's really clear.
Yeah.
I think to most every Reiki student is this. I mean, in my life, I've met amazing healers that have had maybe a Satori experience through many different ways, you know, and motivations, but they're not able to teach, and that's what Sally Hammond, in this book, We Are All Healers, that's what she really pointed out, that of all these amazing healers that she interviewed, that Hawaii Totata was the only person that could actually pass this on. So that became something that has been really a revelation. So I'm just wondering then, if we get back to cosmology, I've had a lot of discussions with people about this. You know, like the question is, what is the goal of Reiki for a student?
Right.
Is it having a Satori experience? Do we have these experiences naturally? Are they inherent in a long-term practice? Are we working toward enlightenment of some kind? And in the beginning, because there were so many students who were influenced by the Indian culture, East Indian culture, and the guru experience, that for them, you know, what their kind of goal was in Reiki was to become enlightened.
Right.
And I said, well, I really don't know if this is an accurate expectation. I mean, we're talking about what I would call a healing practice. So if you would say that ultimate healing is to be enlightened, then, or is an enlightened state of being, then okay, maybe we're saying the same thing, but I have to fall back on my understanding of the basic of this principle, which has to do with healing. Healing in order to make the body and the spirit of a person whole.
Yeah.
Right? So is that something that you could call in some, through some religious filter, enlightenment?
I think so. I think that is, I mean, from what I understand from the Japanese sources, there, that is the goal. It's not, I mean, physical healing, they say, is almost like a doorway to, because the body has to be, the body has to be whole before the mind, you know, whatever you want to call it, the mind, the heart mind, the spirit, can also be at peace. That it's very, it's much more difficult to find peace when the body is ailing. And so it seems that what I've read, that the healing, the physical healing, is an initial stage toward a more holistic kind of peace and peace. The term that was used in the notes that Doi cited was Anshin Ritsume. And both of those terms by themselves, Anshin and Ritsume, mean like peace of mind. But when you put them together, I think it's used in a religious context as a type of enlightenment. as mm-hmm. and maybe what we say in English is equanimity, right? Which is neither craving nor aversion, right? The equanimity right. of Buddha. That's right. a major thing from early Buddhism, and that might be something like that idea of peace of mind, where uh-huh. One is at ease with the world,
uh-huh.
and it seems like that is certainly one of the goals. The original Usui organization, or at least, you know, it definitely founded by the time of his death, was called, you know, the Shinshin Kaizen, which is the improvement of body and, you know, heart mind.
Uh-huh.
And so certainly the physical healing is not the only thing, is evident right in the name of the organization.
Right.
That on at least a mental, emotional level, you know, that to have some sort of improvement, which, mm-hmm. you know, Kaizen is one of these words, you know, it was like taken from Japanese culture in like the 1980s business, like self, like the business literature, like Kaizen,
yeah.
to be continually improving in every way and whatever. But you see it in the 1920s Reiki world, which I think is funny. But it's an idea of getting better, and in I think in the higher levels of development, you realize that can also be in a spiritual sense
uh-huh.
of kind of feeling fulfilled as a human being. So the goal of Reiki, you might say, is also, you know, could be understood as the goal of life, right? To feel fulfilled as a human being on this planet, and to be kind to others, and to, you know, what have you.
Right.
I mean, and to be able to do it properly.
Right.
Because there's a lot of Buddhist stories about compassion coming from a good intention, but the person who's giving it not being in the right place to do it properly. And so I think that's maybe, you know, the whole idea of self-treatment in you know, our lineage, I guess, is that the idea of getting oneself proper, in the proper place first, in order to be able to help others properly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure this is really is this cosmology? I feel like we're in like ethics or in the goal of Reiki.
The goal of Reiki. Well, that's one big thing. You know, it's like we're. The parts of the cosmology that I can identify is there's always a creation story.
Mm-hmm.
There is always what might be called an end result, mm-hmm. you know, what you work toward.
Right.
There is the attitude between your creation, the creation of the world, and the creation of who we are as human beings, to where we as human beings are striving to go. And I think that the really interesting conversations sometimes come on, well, you know, for some people, they think that if they get to the goal, then they've made it.
Hmm.
But other people say, but it's the path that is important.
Right.
And so the discussions on both ends of the spectrum lead us to many, many different places in between, right?
True.
so it's like, for instance, when you were saying about healing the body, it's like, so here I am having a metastasis of cancer, and I seem to be doing really well with it. I don't have symptoms of the cancer. It's not growing right now. It may actually be receding.
Wow.
When do I feel like my body has healed itself?
Mm.
You know, is it my mind or my way of being? Because, you know, I woke up about in February, so that was about 6 months ago, thinking to myself, I'm healthy.
Hmm.
Like, why am I acting like I'm, you know, unhealthy? And I've done this, I said to myself, well, you've done this for like over 5 years now, just related to yourself as having cancer. And that's okay, because it was a great gift. And I don't feel like I could have gotten where I am inside without it. That was the purpose of my having cancer. But there's also a purpose about understanding and looking at life as something that I'm ready to take on as a healthy person, rather than take on underneath this kind of fog of having cancer, yeah. Right? So that's made a huge difference in my life. And I feel that, so that's where my question comes from. It's like when you say, well, first you start with the body, but what does that really mean?
Yeah. It's right. When is your task done, right? What is...
Right.
I mean, you see it in people who want to live a natural life. You know, how natural is natural? You know, like where okay, you can start, you know, getting processed foods out of your diet, but then, you know, well, you know, or what about organic agriculture versus conventional agriculture? Okay, so then, okay, we start having organic, but then what if they're shipped from the other side of the world? You know, okay, so we have local organic, you know, it's like, when... Is it enough? So how healthy is healthy, right? When can you say, okay, I am healthy? You know, is it when you're living pain-free? Is it, you know, having your blood tests done and they're within certain ranges of all the, I mean.
Right,
it's, and exactly. So like you say, there's something about the subjective experience of it and saying, I am well. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, something I wanted to learn more about is about, you know, the experience of being a patient, right? And say that, you know, the role of diagnosis in kind of selfhood, and saying, you know, for example, if you receive the diagnosis of depression, right? And then people say, you know, he is a depressive.
Right.
It becomes your identity.
Right.
And so...
And a lot of people really are against this.
And so, you know, alcoholism is another one, right? So, you know, that the whole thing of 12-step is to take that identity on and say, this is who I am, and this is who, and this is, and even if I haven't had a drink in years, I am an alcoholic.
Right.
And it's just different approaches, I think, to healing and to therapy. I don't know. It's just something I don't know a ton about, but I'm really interested in learning more about.
Uh-huh.
Is kind of the relationship between diagnosis, selfhood, like identity, and healing and therapy.
Right. Well, it's really interesting if you apply this to someone who has a physical disability that's not going to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, in my early days of being a master and... So, and I used to go to Winter Park, Colorado, where they have a huge disabled ski program.
Oh, right.
And, you know, I had the great fortune to be very good friends with the man who founded the program and who is, I hope, still running the program. And we set up Reiki tables within the ski room, and when the skiers would come back off the mountain and just want to just flop, we would ask them if they wanted to flop on a Reiki table, and we would give them Reiki. And a couple of the amputees would say, well, are you going to grow back a leg for me? And I would say, well, I don't think so. And then they would say, well, what does it mean to be healed?
Mm-hmm.
And this is such a great question.
Right.
And for Hal, the head of this program, for him, he saw with great passion every one of those people in the program as whole.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his gift to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they met Hal, they met a man who said, you're whole. And we have to get you on the mountain mm-hmm. so that you can feel that wholeness. And it didn't matter what it took, equipment-wise,
mm-hmm.
to get the person there. Mm. He did it.
Yeah.
And it was really thrilling to be with him during that time, and also just raised an enormous amount of questions for me.
Yeah.
Like, why are we doing Reiki on these people? people, and what is our expectation, and what will we do, mm-hmm. and so on. So it was really interesting because one of the fellows had a really bad case of cerebral palsy, mm-hmm. and when I first met him, for some bizarre reason, the ski area gave him the job of clearing tables, which was really nutso.
I'm sure.
Because he could hardly feed himself.
Oh, man.
But what happened with him is that as he skied, he got in better and better shape, and his palsy got less and less. And when he started receiving Reiki treatments, he actually had a couple of nights where his palsy went to such a minimum that it scared him. I don't think that it would have taken the palsy away, but it would have made his life really different. Mm. And he said, you know, I've got a job here because I have CP.
Wow.
And that was...
It reminds me of the story of the beggars.
It was really interesting to run into that and to talk to him about like the what ifs of this. Right. And I said, well, I really trust that Hal is not going to fire you because you don't shake. So, you know, you still have CP, you know, whether you have the mm-hmm. symptomology
right.
of it,
right.
it doesn't matter. And, anyway, he just couldn't deal with coming anymore to the sessions.
Huh.
But it again raised these questions. What comes first? Or is there a methodology of first? So this is another cosmology, you know, question. Like, mm-hmm. do we start with the physical plane and then move to the other planes and then somehow...
Mm-hmm.
Wholeness is a state of being rather than a state of mind, rather than a picture of physical wholeness.
Right.
Right? So I'm just wondering
yeah.
how that is for you.
Well, the way it's always been explained to me from when I first got into Reiki and stuff
uh-huh.
was kind of the Chinese medical model of circulation and stagnation, and that when the qi is flowing properly,
uh-huh.
the body is well. And, you know, when there are blockages or stagnations, deficiencies or excesses, that there is pain or disease. And but at the same time, I don't really see that in the teaching of the lineage. Like, is that something that Takata talked about?
No.
I mean, I don't see it in Hayashi or Usui, what we have of their manuals, really, either. And I'm wondering, you know, how... But you do talk about flow in Reiki, right? Where you feel it moving. You know, you do feel
uh-huh.
the Reiki moving. We talk about it moving through the practitioner into the patient,
mm-hmm.
or the recipient, through the hands. And... sometimes there certainly is the opening of a blockage or something like that when you're giving a treatment to someone and all of a sudden there's a crack or something, you know, there's something
yeah.
opens up and maybe they start crying or they start, you know, they feel a certain way or there's a rush of something, you know, I mean, you see that happening. And I wonder, you know, I wonder how that, you guys, I mean, have you heard people talk about Reiki in that way? That there's, you know, it kind of... pain or disease is the result of an energetic blockage?
Yeah. For me, blockage is a word that I don't like using.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes physically it feels like that there's a kind of door that's closed and it needs to be opened, and what keeps it closed is the person's fear, mm-hmm. usually, of what will happen when the door is open. So in that way, yes, I can see that. But, you know, in my memory, Hawaii Takata never talked about these kind of things because the message that I got loud and clear was that everybody was able to practice Reiki no matter what. Everybody was able to receive Reiki no matter what. And the receiving of Reiki worked in the person naturally, like however, whatever the person needed would happen through Reiki. And so some people equated this with intelligence. So this is a piece that I don't want in the cosmology, because for me, Reiki is not intelligence. That's a kind of way of humanizing and making Reiki much smaller than it really is. I feel that it looks like intelligence because usually it works in a way that, that is with the natural flow, and we as human beings often don't think in the natural flow. So we go, wow, that was really simple. And, you know, if you watch a rock rolling down a hill, you kind of get the same message, right. But we don't, we, our idea is how to stop the rock or how to have the rock move uphill. And this is, you know, our training from day one as human beings. So it's a very interesting process for me to get people back into really marveling at the miracle of the natural world, right, and how it works.
And so it's really interesting because it sounds like, okay, so the person sees a rock rolling down a hill and they say, oh, the rock wants to go down, right? It's like it's assigning.
It's moving.
Right. But so when you say Reiki is intelligent, when Takata says the Reiki will go where it needs to go.
Right.
You say, oh, the Reiki must know something.
Right.
But really it's just a natural
flow.
But at the same time, there is human intention involved in it. That without a person being without a practitioner laying their hands on or doing a distance treatment, the Reiki won't go, right? There is an element where we interact, I guess, with the Reiki, or human intelligence, human compassion, human intention, something is interacting with this natural force, right?
Well, this is the whole Zen koan, right? Does a tree falling in a forest with nobody around make a sound?
Uh-huh.
I'm not quite sure what the wording is.
That's something like that, yeah.
Something like this.
Yeah.
So it's the same kind of question.
Huh.
It's like a lot of scientists have proved that human intention does move things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that I understand. But there is also natural movement that happens no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So there are these questions in my mind. I'll just relate it to my own life.
Sure.
That all through my life, I have had contact with my grandmother, who actually was a Reiki master. But I never knew she was a Reiki master, really, until I was 30. But in all these different moments of my life, my grandmother would say to me, Phyllis, why don't you come to Hawaii and work with me? Why don't you become a nurse? Because she couldn't think of me as a doctor, which really, I mean, I was so irritated by this that I didn't talk to her for a year.
Hmm.
You know, when I was 16 and trying to pick my vocation, she said, be a nurse. And I said, well, what about a doctor? Because my dad was a doctor. She said, oh, women can't be doctors. Mm. And I went, what? And that was it. And in those days, it was very, very unusual,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then, you know, I was really having trouble in school and so on. And she said, oh, just stay in Hawaii and, you know, work with me. And then, you know, I was in my 20s and my life was going downhill again, and she said, come to Waimea, and we'll start a Reiki clinic. And I went, Reiki? Why? Why Reiki? So, you know, at the end of her life, when she's 80, almost 80, 78, she decides that she's bored with retirement, plans a secret trip from my mother, and that's 3 months long. I mean, it's not like
wow.
2 weeks
yeah.
or something. It's
yeah.
like 3 months. Because she decides if she escapes from, you know, where she's living in this small town in Iowa, she might as well go for good, right?
Right.
So my mom gets that she's not going to change her mother's mind, right? She's going on this trip
yeah.
no matter what. So her next strategy is to get one of her kids to go with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it was me. And it took me about 5 months to say yes. And when I did, little did I know that that was the path that had always been there for me. Mm-hmm. And somehow I was ready to take it.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't know at all.
But I didn't know at all. So when you look at it in that context, it's like, you know, a lot of people say, well, you were given lots of opportunity to do it. Your life would have been different had you chose when you were 18 or when you were 23 or when you were 28. But you chose it when you were 30. So at this point, your life is now on track somehow. And I've always felt that no matter how much I fought against it, mm-hmm. that this was really my destiny, so to speak. And I feel like that's the flow of life. And at that point, I wasn't practicing Reiki at all. Mm-hmm. I had Reiki. I mean, I had been initiated actually in second degree by that time. But, you know, I wasn't doing self-treatment. I wasn't consciously aware. I had no intention of becoming a Reiki master. Mm-hmm. And here I am.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe it was my mother and my grandmother's intention.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That eventually. So this is the thing, the question you had, but we had before about the patient, because, you know, I felt energy like bouncing off of people. Where uh-huh. it feels like they have some sort of armor or shield, you know, shield up, uh-huh. and that they are actively resisting receiving any Reiki from uh-huh. me, through me.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, when you said before about that the patient will naturally absorb, the Reiki will go where it needs to go, I feel like that there is a two-way street between the giver and the receiver, and the receiver has to, in some level, whether it's conscious or unconscious, be ready for it or be wanting it. And when you talk about that in the exchange of energies idea, right?
Yeah. But I'm going somewhere else.
Okay, but it seems like at this point that she was trying to give it to you and trying to give it to you for uh-huh. so long, and you were actively resisting it.
Right.
And that's that when true. You finally submitted and said, okay, I'll take the gift, all of a sudden, you know, it changed, right?
Right.
Something changed. I think there's something to that.
Right.
I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think so, man. It's really fascinating, but where my mind went, okay. so I got to go sure. with this before I lose it, is that when you're giving, when I'm treating someone mm-hmm. and I feel that they, well, how I describe it is not about resistance in an intentional way, but I feel that when I put my hands on a person's body, the cells in that person's body are often, well, they're not used to Reiki. Right. And so sometimes when those cells feel the Reiki, they go, wow, this is kind of a foreign energy. I don't know if I really, you know, if this is really beneficial for me. And so I feel like it's a little bit like melting the ice around every cell. So eventually, if I treat long enough, the flow will start happening.
Hmm.
The same with new students. If they just are initiated in the beginning, sometimes it takes 5, 10, 15 minutes for the energy to really feel. Like, I don't know what happens in between. But when we have phenomena of the hands getting warm and so on, then the person knows that they're actually allowing Reiki to flow through them. And in the moment where you were speaking about this, what I realized is that lately I've been telling people in some of my workshops, because the intent on treating people in the workshop is not to heal them. It's to actually sit in the energy of Reiki. So what happens is that, you know, I treat the person and the person treats me. Usually we're all pretty healthy, so there's no really intense physical symptomology going on. But the energy in the room with 14 or 15 couples or pairs of people treating with Reiki, the energy gets so intense that eventually you don't feel the separation between the person that you're treating and the person sitting over there who's treating somebody else. You end up in this energetic field. So you've moved from being the individual to being the whole and experiencing that part, that being a part of the whole. So back to our first our first piece. This is something that's moving through the Reiki community more and more. Mostly, I think, because we're getting more mature in our Reiki practice. Mm-hmm. So a treatment can have many different intentions. It can actually be to help somebody with a migraine headache. It can be to help heal a broken bone faster. It can be to help resolve fear in someone. And it can be to add to the energy field of a certain area. So, and then probably there are other things that go on. So I feel like we're just increasing our understanding of the benefits of Reiki treatment. And they're not always so linear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't feel like I have much to add to that. I think that's really, I mean, yeah, it's, I mean, the one thing that came to mind when you were talking about the individual and the whole in the room was, have you ever heard of a guy named David Kubiak? He was like a big
guy
in Kyoto, in the expat scene in Kyoto. And, I think at one point, he ran as an ex-American, you know, living in Kyoto, ran for mayor of Kyoto, I think. And, but he talks about big bodies and about kind of societies being bodies of which humans are cells, of which individuals are cells.
Right.
And it sounded a lot like, you know, that you guys became a bigger form in
right.
the room. And I was thinking about the Reiki community, because when we talk about, you know, the future of Reiki, or some people I've spoken to are talking about, you know, send like a number of people all together sending distance Reiki to a war zone or uh-huh. something like that. And, or I know William Rand has the thing with the crystal grids in the north and south pole of the planet. And if you send Reiki to those grids, it's to heal the earth as an entity, as a whole.
Uh-huh.
If thousands of people are doing this every day, that all of this distance Reiki will kind of resonate with each other to produce an effect far bigger than the sum of its parts or something
right.
like that.
Right.
And that's the only thing I was thinking of when you were talking uh-huh. about that section. But then a lot, yeah, then you kept going. And I was just listening.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so we've kind of touched on the creation, we've touched on the goal, and we've touched on the process
uh-huh.
of a student. And I feel that there is another piece that wants to be spoken of, and that is... how much does the physical world really affect the energetic field that we are moving in? And we could call that energetic field Reiki. So, for instance, what I'm thinking about is this whole very major conversation about the history of Reiki. And you know, I always feel very envious, sort of, about reading the story of, say, Buddha, who there's a lot of documentation And there's a lot of acceptance about that documentation. So there aren't a lot of arguments about whether Buddha actually lived or existed or, you know,
that's
like
true.
That. And we seem to have a yin-yang about that in our own system. Now, we can say that that's because it's a young developmental entity.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. But how real, it's kind of a loaded question because this is exactly what your thesis is about. How much do you think that that really impacts the actual work of Reiki on the planet?
Well, that is a loaded question.
You don't have to answer.
Okay, let's back up a step before we get into there. But the first thing you said about Reiki being so young and that we're grappling with these, you know, questions of historicity.
Uh-huh.
I think in a way that, you know, let's say a couple of generations removed from Buddha, that they probably were as well. And I think, I don't know the history of the Indian part of Buddhism as well, but I think there was a period where they were saying, okay, which of these sutras are real sutras
uh-huh.
and which of these aren't and what goes in the basket and what gets
right.
left aside. And I think we're kind of in that period. And I think there is you started off by saying the interaction between the physical world and the energetic world. I mean, that's something we can only speculate about, I think, on some level. I mean, you could talk about one's own mystical experience and
right.
how you interpret that experience into human terms. But, you know, I mean, it's hard to say, right? I mean, and, you know, you talked about that this path had been available to you for so many years, and then you finally said yes to it. I mean, it seems like there's a lot going on invisibly that we may be conscious of on a certain level, but that, you know, we only are seeing a very small sliver of what's going on around
Definitely.
Us at any time.
Definitely.
And which influences which, I'd say, is probably a two-way street.
Right.
I mean, there's some religions will say the spirit comes first and the physical follows. And so everything that happens on the physical level was either preordained or determined on some way or...
by a decision made years before.
Yeah, and not even that the decision, is it your decision or is it...
Oh, right.
Right, kind of either destiny, fate, or, you know, a complex interaction of external forces or, you know, God
right.
or whatever you want,
right.
you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of questions there. Now, in terms of historicity and Reiki practice, let's take it down a little bit.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I think there are implications. I think obviously the practice evolves. I mean, we're not trying to put Reiki practice in a glass case and say, you know, whatever existed in 1926 is what is going to exist in the future and anything
right.
else can be thrown. I mean, people learn how to do things over time. Like Usui had this original experience and he, it seems like probably changed the practice over the last few years of his life, from, you know, 22, let's say when he had this experience to 26, when he made his transition. And certainly his students probably made further changes
Definitely.
After his passing. And so, on that level, the historicity thing, it's not to determine the true authentic form that we now are going to
uh-huh.
do forever. But at the same time, there is something about being given a gift by your teacher and wanting to honor that and wanting to do things in a way that is effective and is meaningful and is respectful, I guess, both to the teacher and to the recipient.
Uh-huh.
And so I think on that level, the more we find out about what our teachers and our teachers' teachers were doing, I think we can get better at that. You know, at maybe practices that we once poo-pooed, let's say.
Right.
And then we find out, oh, wait a minute, you know, Hayashi was doing that or something like
no,
that.
No, I totally relate.
I can totally relate. And then, I mean, that could have, I think, implications for the future of practice.
Definitely.
So on that level, I think so.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's not necessarily the reason I do what I do, but I think it's a important thing to keep in mind as I'm doing my work.
Right, know? For sure, yeah. For sure. And an important thing to keep in mind as we, as students, go through our own development of what's important in the Reiki practice and what's not. Like, is it important for our Reiki master to be the best and most perfect master? Is it important for the form of what we practice to be the true form? Is it important for, for this to be the best practice to take us to the goal of Reiki, whatever that happens to be?
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that I'm really visualizing these days, which brings up a lot of questions, but also a very interesting piece sort of in my head, is that if I think about, say that there's this choir piece that's called Reiki, and there are all these different voices singing or toning this tone we call Reiki, then for me, the truth of what our experience as human beings are in relationship to the energy of Reiki has to take in order to be accurate, has to take in all the different expressions of Reiki.
The thing is, I hope they're all in key, you know, like that.
Well, they won't be, though, probably.
Yeah, for chord, you know, for harmony and resonance and whatever, you know. But the thing is, it's really interesting because I think, you know, it's 2014. And so about 20 years ago, the internet has a major role in the history of Reiki. And that when people started finding each other through the internet and becoming conscious of the world of Reiki outside of the people they've actually met face to face or read about, let's say, in a book.
Right.
Things really started changing. And I feel like now it's like one generation, right? It's been 20 years.
Yes.
Or
yeah, 20 years.
Right around now, right? And so when I think the world of Reiki and the lineages becoming conscious of one another and the Reiki world almost becoming self-conscious in a way, or self-aware.
Self-aware. Let's say self-aware.
Self-aware, yeah. Because self-conscious has that other meaning, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm getting chicken skin a little bit. I've been also feeling weird throughout this interview. But I think that it's an exciting time. And hopefully, like you said, it's a time of like convergence and consonance and resonance where differences can be appreciated. And, you know, that like you said, you know, what is the true practice? You know, will the real Reiki please step forward? You know, it's like that kind of question is recognized as being non-productive.
Non-productive and passé, actually. Because if expression of Reiki doesn't last through a 5-year period or even 10 years, then you could say, well, that wasn't something that had the energy behind it. But a lot of these practices that I thought would never last 2 years are now 25 years old. So I have to, you know, I just have to take that little fact, whatever that means, and say, okay, there's validity in this form of practice for these people. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be valid for me for a number of reasons, but it doesn't mean that it's invalid for everyone. So I think that one of the things that is happening right now is that part of the cosmology of Reiki is for us as a Reiki community to basically follow the old axiom to practice what we preach. Mm-hmm. So here we are.
And that's right. That's right.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
And you look at, I mean, the, you know, in the Reiki ideals, right, or the Reiki precepts,
right.
I mean, be kind to others, and it's, you've seen a lot of infighting in the Reiki world, and it's a little ironic, right? I mean.
It is very ironic, but very human.
That's true.
So
that's ideals, right?
Right. And so if we can mature to that, and in my language, show gratitude to every living thing, then we will have moved in our development as a community to the next step. And that's exciting. And I feel like we're going there. Yeah. So really wonderful.
I'm happy to be here with you.
Thanks. Well, thank you. It was a great hour.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Me too. I appreciate, yeah, as I said, it's wonderful to be with you as we're talking about this stuff. You know,
great.
It's an honor.
Great. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, balancing form and essence.